Hello, duck hunters. If you have your duck and goose call handy, let's start practicing. We will begin by learning the quack. The quack is done by a grunting sound in your throat, and the air is forced up from your diaphragm. Your lips should be closed before you grunt, but right after the grunt, allow the air to escape very slowly between your teeth. Now, without your duck call, make this sound. Oops, oops. With your duck call, make this sound. Practice this over and over. Finally, begin putting them together in sequence. Here is the call of the wild mallard hen sitting on water. Next is the feed call. Say ticka, 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 ticka. Now with your duck call. For the mating call, say kitty kit, kitty kit, kitty 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 kit. With your duck call, begin with your hand closed and open it near the end of the kit. Here's duck calling is done in various parts of the country. The Bean Lake, Missouri open water highball. Here's duck calling is done near the Mertazine River at Fontana, Kansas. Here's duck calling is done on Real Foot Lake, Tennessee, including the famous Real Foot Lake highball. And here is duck calling as done in the flooded timber at Stuttgart, Arkansas.
You're listening to Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM Acra Catskill Radio for Open Ears, and my name is Mayuko. This program is Bequency, Meet Bird People in the Hudson Valley. Bequency invites the local community to be inspired by the joy, beauty, and wisdom bird enthusiasts find in the nature of our neighborhoods. Every episode features an interview with local bird people, plus a freeform mix of sound made by birds and humans inspired by birds. And speaking of sound made by humans inspired by birds, we started today's show with demonstration and instructions on duck calling. This particular recording was performed by J.C. Higgins, and I played it off of a compilation titled Wiser Than the Wisdom of Geese, U.S. Game Culture Discs, 1940s to 50s, which was put together and came out, released by Canary Records in 2020. And I wanted to play this, you know, duck and hunting related things today's show because of my today's guest. Bequency welcomes Pat Walsh, the owner of Swamp Angel Antiques in downtown Catskill on Main Street in Catskill. The store gives us a glimpse into life in the Catskills over the past century. Swamp Angel Antiques is located in the Day and Holt building, which was built in 1818. And home to the Walsh family's hardware business since 1912. And today, the space is filled with charming vintage hand tools, collectibles, and duck decoys. Ducks have been a part of Pat's life since his childhood days at his family's hunting camp. And the natural beauty of these birds is on full display in the form of decoys at his store. And Pat shares the history and stories behind them. And in this interview, he also tells us how the environment and regulations surrounding waterfowl and hunters have changed over time and the role hunters have played in conservation efforts. So I hope you enjoy the interview. Thanks for listening. This is Bequency on WGXC. Well, so like I mentioned when I introduced myself, I'm pretty ignorant about hunting and guns and all that stuff. I was born in the suburb of Japan and spent most of my life in urban area. And so many of my questions may come from ignorant place. I hope you forgive me for that. And I really wanted to ask hunters about like how they look at the world, because bird watchers and hunters, they both deeply care about bird conservation, even though their relationships are very different. Mm-hmm. Our relationship with birds are very different. And so thank you so much for taking time today to speak with me. Could you briefly introduce yourself first?
Yeah, my name is Pat Walsh, and I'm a lifetime Catskill resident. I worked in the family hardware business actually since I was in high school in the 50s, and then full-time since 1962. And with my brother as in the business. Now, my grandfather started the business in 1900, or he started working here in 1900 and bought the business in 1912. So I was third generation in the hardware business.
So the store had been here.
The store has been here, and there was a hardware business here since 1818 when the building was built.
Wow.
And it turned over to a few owners since then, and the Day and Holtz, which is our name now, bought the business in 1880. And then my grandfather worked for them, and then he bought the business in 1912 and expanded it, put the building next door, and that was history.
And you said your grandfather, was it your grandfather who came from Ireland?
My great-grandfather came from Ireland.
So and your grandfather was born here?
Yes.
Also?
Yeah.
In Catskill?
In Catskill, yeah. Well, we got out of the hardware business in 2006, mainly to get time off. You know, I was spending 6 days a week here all my life, and it was very hard to get away for do a vacation or do something else, you know. I always found time to go duck hunting in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really got into fishing because I never had the time. And I never played golf because I didn't have the time. But I kept the hunting part of it. And mainly because we had the camp on the river. And, you know, if it wasn't for that, I may have drifted away from it also, you know. But with that, it kept us, it's like a home away from home. And it was a beautiful spot. You know, we spent a lot of time in the summer there, you know, just, you know, hanging out and cooking and spending the night and stuff, so.
And that's exactly which town you said?
It's in town. It's actually a mile south of here on the river.
Okay.
Have you heard of the Ramshorn Creek?
Ramshorn, that's Ramshorn Livingston
Marsh. Yeah.
Okay, so around
okay,
there.
We're 300 yards south of the Ramshorn Creek entrance mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So I can be out my back door and my boat and be there in 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very convenient, you know. And some people have homes up in the Adirondacks and it takes them hours to get there.
Right.
You know, I can be there in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
and that photo is from there too. We're looking at a picture of your family. You, your brother,
your father
in the would you say canoe?
Hmm?
A boat?
That was a boat. They were made in Catskill by a guy named Brenner in the wintertime from probably 1900 to 1925 or 30.
Mm-hmm.
He would build duck boats in the wintertime because he was slow on order. And that was one of them. We had actually two of those, but.
So there are a lot of duck decoys in the store.
Mm-hmm.
Antique duck decoys?
There's some. They're both contemporary and antique.
They've been always part of your business? Or?
No, not the hardware business, no. When we morphed into the antique business, we decided to gravitate on the things we like, the old tools and the decoys, you know. I started reading books on furniture, and I'd fall asleep, you know, trying to learn about furniture. I knew something about it, but I mean, you know, to really learn, you have to know things.
Mm.
And the name Swamp Angel actually came from the names of the fellows at the duck camp. When my father bought the property back in 1949. He had a bunch of guys that hunted there, and they called themselves the Swamp Angels. So we gave the name. We decided to give the name with the decoys and stuff.
I see.
To the Swamp Angel Antiques.
Mm-hmm. And I saw there were some name tags that sort of displayed with each batch of duck
decoys. Those are carvers, you know, known carvers, you know, and some aren't. I mean, some are. You know, nobody knows who carved them, you know, but because they just were carved and used, and then they, you know, they were collected or didn't get thrown in. Just a little background, but in 1918, the United States passed a migratory game law that prohibited market hunting. They waited that long because Canada wouldn't go along with them, I think. And it wouldn't be much sense if the United States did it and Canada didn't do it, you know, didn't pass a law to control market hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, the market hunters used to use hundreds of decoys, you know, hundreds of decoys to attract ducks. So a lot of these guys just, you know, put them into firewood, you know, their firewood.
Oh.
You know, that was it. You know, they had no use for them anymore. So in the early time, the decoy collectors back in the 50s and 40s, they would go around and pack their vans or their station wagons with plastic decoys, mm-hmm. and go around and trade them for wooden decoys. They were ahead of their time because a lot of these guys didn't care about the wooden decoys. They were in the shed out back. And in fact, I grew up hunting with wood decoys, and I didn't like them because they were so heavy. You know, you had to move them in, move them out in the boat. So, you know, so when the plastic decoys came out, you bought plastic decoys. They're relatively cheap, and you just use them. And they look, you know, probably better than some of the wood decoys. Mm. Anyway, that was the deal with decoys back then. A lot of the carvers today actually use their decoys to hunt with, and then they sell them after they use them. And they also sell them, they make them to sell.
Can I ask a question before?
Oh, yeah, sure.
When you say marketing hunters, those are the people who hunt and
they would hunt strictly for the market. You know, they would kill hundreds of ducks a day.
So this is for consumers?
For consumers. And they ship them in ice to the metropolitan areas, you know, to New York, wherever the closest city was. They'd be all packed in barrels on ice. And they would get, 150 years ago, back in the mid-1800s, they would, for certain species ducks, canvasbacks mainly, they would get a dollar a pair. And that was a week's salary for somebody.
Right.
For a couple of ducks. I mean, and it was hard work, and obviously, and they did it at night. I mean, they slaughtered ducks, actually, back then. But at the time, they never thought they'd run out of ducks because the sky would blacken with them. You know, when they migrated, that would be totally... But, you know, and some of the hunters back then started being concerned because they noticed that some of the ducks weren't as plentiful as they were. Mm-hmm. So they started, you know, promoting conservation because they knew trying to, you know, get the politicians to set limits, you know, set times, you know, when they could hunt. Mm-hmm. And so that morphed into that, you know. And of course, the old-timers didn't like that at all, but...
Okay, so that ended really because of the conservation concerns.
Oh, yeah. And you know, they knew they were going to run out of ducks if they kept doing it.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
In fact, a couple of species were actually eliminated, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Pat Walsh, the owner of Swamp Angel Antiques on Main Street in Catskill. Thank you for listening. This is Bequency on WGXE 90.7 FM.
Well, so, okay, thank you. Going back to the decoys, I wanted to ask more about the decoys. Mm-hmm. And so the ones you carry now in the store, mm-hmm. how do you find them?
Well, most of our decoys we bought at auction. We went to decoy auctions. We go to three or four decoy auctions a year, one in Jersey, one in the Cape Cod, and one in Maine. And that's where we bought most of our decoys. But they also had what they call tailgating. You know, the dealers or people with had decoys for sale, they would be there at the auctions, and you could buy them there from them. Mm-hmm. There are also carvers that you could buy them from, you know, that, you know, contemporary carvers, obviously.
Right.
And but generally, we waited for the auction. And when we first started, we were terrible. I mean, you know, we buy stuff that was junk almost, you know, because, you know, we didn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. We started around 2000, we started going to auctions. And the first few, we learned very quickly, mm-hmm. not to buy the junk,
uh-huh.
you know. And I say junk, it, at the time it looked okay, but, you know, we didn't research enough. We didn't know a lot. And we learned pretty quickly that to be a little more discretionary and pick certain decoys out and try to buy them at a certain price.
Hmm. What makes it a junk decoy? What was the...
Well, it's been beat up, you know, it's been painted a bunch of times, you know. I picked up one after one of the first auctions we went to, and we went to pick up the few we bought, and we didn't have a lot of money then either. I mean, we don't have a lot of money now, but, you know, then we had... Very, you know, so we had, but we were caught up in it, mm-hmm. you know, and I always had decoys, you know, some, and And when we got into it about then, and we started collecting ourselves, and we were buying also for resale.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, so you had to try to buy them at a price you think you can resell them at also.
Right. There are many different artists with unique style. I mean,
they all have their own actual style.
Yeah.
And the way they carve. The first thing I tell people if they're going to buy a decoy out there is you gotta like to look at it. You know, when you walk by it, if you buy it, you want to be able to smile when you see it, you know,
mm-hmm.
because it's attractive to you, you know.
Right.
I mean, it may not be attractive
right.
for me, but, to you, it's attractive. And then you look at and try to buy it if it's been not overpainted, you know, original paint. And then you look at maybe the carver, you know, is something, you know, that I collect certain carvers, because they're good, their provenance is there, and you like the looks of them, you know, and the structure, I guess the structure is important too, you know, if they're not, you know, banged up or broken or.
Mm.
So those are the four things you kind of look for, and the first thing though, you look at it, you like it,
right?
You know, and.
What kind of duck decoy do you think would speak to you personally? Like, is it something you can verbalize?
I gravitate toward the decoys that we hunt. You know, the mallards, the black ducks, the teal, the wood ducks,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So when you choose decoys, that's one of the things that attracts you, that it's something that the species that... being part
to
of
me, yeah, but I mean, I'll look at anything. But again, canvasbacks, we don't see many of them up here, but some beautiful, you know, some.
Mm-hmm.
So you do collect other ones, but again, if I'm generally collecting something, it's something that, you know, I hunted, that we hunt around here anyway.
Mm-hmm. Duck species sighted around the Hudson Valley has changed a lot over the time. Some species
hasn't changed a lot, you know. Although, when I was growing up, we hardly ever saw geese here, you know, on the river. Anyway, they go sometimes late in the fields on the way through. But now there's geese all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But wood ducks are the most prominent duck, native duck, and there's mallards and the teal. They migrate through. They don't really nest here.
Mm-hmm.
Diving ducks are usually prone to big water, you know, so there's not a lot of big water here. I don't know why they don't come right down the Hudson River Valley and go to get south, but they seem to gravitate to the shore, I guess, the ocean for some reason, because this isn't a big flyway. I mean, we get our share of ducks, but not, you know, where you think you would.
Hmm. So I wanted to ask you also how you started hunting, but I guess your family's been hunting.
Basically, yeah. My father got that the camp. I grew up down there, you know, getting firewood and just hanging around, you know, down there doing work or whatever, doing whatever had to be done. And then I started hunting when I was 14. We stayed at the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be myself and the other couple of kids, my cousin, we had to sleep on the porch.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, all the guys were inside, the adults were inside playing cards, and they got the bunks inside.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, and it was just, yeah, that's what you did, you know. When you grow up, we grew up, I guess, if you didn't have something to do, you would put to work.
Uh-huh.
You know, basically. So you knew that it was better to be working down there than hanging around the house and making
right.
and doing something else. But
do you remember how old you were the first time you shot a duck or whatever it was?
I was probably when I was 14. I remember the first time I shot a shotgun, I was probably about 10. And my father and uncle owned the boatyard down here, which wasn't much of a boatyard, but it was, and they at that time, right in the village, and they gave me a shotgun, or we were down there, and they were shooting across the creek.
Mm-hmm.
It almost knocked me down, you know. I mean, it wasn't a big shotgun either, but but it, you know, it got my attention.
Were you afraid?
No, never was afraid, but didn't know what was going to happen, but I didn't think it was going to do that, you know, hammering my shoulder. And,
uh-huh.
You know.
And then you have to learn how to dress them. Is that the word, dress?
Dress them out?
The bird, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, that was one of our jobs, you know. All the, you know. Back then, we dressed the whole duck. Now, what we do is we just take the breasts to eat them. You know, it's 75-80% of the meat, and the rest is just not, you know, this isn't worth the effort, you know, to me. I mean, but, I mean, obviously, you know, 100 years ago, they ate every little bit, you know. And,
right.
And because that was it, I mean.
And so when you first shot the duck, you also dressed the duck yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Or you had been doing that already?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, he showed me. Yeah, I mean, I dressed most of the ducks at the camp at the time, you know. He plucked them. Well, first of all, you take their innards out. You know, you cut them, take their innards out. Peel that, the feathers off there. Then you'd hang them. And then when you took them home the next day or so, you would dress them out. You know, pluck them, and my mother used to tell me don't bring, because you had to pick out the shot in them too, the bird shot. And my mother used to say, don't bring them home unless you shot them in the head, because she'd sit there trying to get the and that's another bone of contention. But we used to use lead shot, obviously, and it's a good thing they went to steel shot. But the problem there is, you know, if you bite into a lead shot, you know, it's a little forgiving, but if you bite into a steel shot, the dentists are happy to see you because they're going to probably break a tooth.
I heard of people concerned about the lead bullet. What exactly the issue and how is it banned now?
I don't think lead bullets are lead shot when it was shot over a field and stuff. The birds, waterfowl especially, they eat grit. To clean their gullet, it gets in their gullet and cleans their gullet. Mm-hmm. And if they pick up lead shot, and then you know, it's gonna eventually it'll dissolve and maybe kill them or, you know, hurt their health anyway. Certainly, and that was the primaries. I don't know over water what it would do, you know, but the lead was pretty inert. It's not gonna dissolve really, but your acid would dissolve it in a bird's stomach. Mm. I don't know. It's a good thing. Don't get me wrong. It had to be done, the non-toxic shot. It's a learning curve too. Because when they first came out with steel shot, I had old shotguns, and I couldn't shoot the steel shot through it because it would hurt the barrels because they're softer barrels.
I see.
So I had to go out and buy a new shotgun. I bought a cheap shotgun just so I could go hunting with it, you know.
Well, I see. So that must have been the obstacle for people to switch from lead shot to steel.
It was different at the time, especially then. The ballistics and everything were bad. You know, you're getting a lot more crippled ducks because people were shooting at the same ranges, and they really weren't deadly at certain ranges then because the lead shot had more impact.
Mm.
So, you know, there was, again, that's another learning curve for the hunters.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got a lot of inexperienced hunters that shoot too far anyway. I always tell anybody I'm with that, you know, make sure they're in range. You know, don't try to, they're more than 40 yards out. Don't bother shooting. Or if you do, you're just going to hurt them. Not.
Do people shoot too early because they're too excited, or
what? Well, too early, or
they just miscalculate.
We're not even close. You know, maybe they didn't even get close enough. You know, a lot of reasons. You know, too excited or. They just think they can get them.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Pat Walsh, the owner of Swamp Angel Antiques on Main Street in Catskill. Thanks for listening. This is B. Quincy on WGXC 90.7 FM.
So you no longer hunt?
No, I stopped. I stopped three years ago at 82.
Oh, that's recent.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, because I'm aging out, you know, I'm unsteady on my feet, and I can't be walking around in the mud and whatever.
Oh, that's impressive, though. I don't know if I can do it now.
I grew up doing it. You know, I used to walk, you know, miles through the swamp and you know, every day, but no more. I've gotten to the point where I don't really want to kill anything anymore, too. You know, I really just, you know, done that, did that, and I don't, you know, and I, you know, you look at it a little differently as you get older. You know, your mortality shows you, I guess, slows you down. I don't know, but I don't. You know, it's different.
It's interesting because some people think hunting is cruel, but then other perception of hunters being they're really in touch with the natural world in a more raw and intimate way. And the way people look at life, you know, the way I look at life, I've been in such an insulated world where I don't have to see animals being killed, even though I eat fish. I love eating fish. I'm not a big fan of meat, but I do eat meat. And so I don't know, honestly, what to think of, you know, taking life away and eat them, because I've been sort of almost protected from, I didn't have to think about those things. Yeah. How would you feel about that if you had any thoughts? Like, did it have any impact on you? Did you, like, really think about you killing something?
No, I'm not. You know, the thing is, I grew up in a time where it was a natural, not a natural, but, you know, everybody did it. I mean, I used to go squirrel hunting, rabbit hunting, and I brought them home, and we cooked them, you know, and it was an adventure almost, you know, to go out and a skill. I mean, to, you know, to be able to harvest the game, you know. What really bothers me is when people just go out to kill it. They don't care. They just leave it. I've seen people do that, and it really drives me crazy. I mean, you know, that kind of person shouldn't be out there at all. You know, so, you know, for whatever reason, but
yeah, it is hard to relate to, especially like a trophy hunting type of thing. It's like, why? Well, you know, what reason? It's it's hard to relate to that. The people who just
I mean, you know, they're not hunting. They're killing. They're not hunting. They're I don't know. It's what the mentality is. You know, but.
Well, I think the other image that people have about hunters, and I think it's not just an image, it's a fact that hunters being played a role in bird conservation efforts. Would you be able to tell us what you think have done in terms of hunters' work?
Well, I'm going to give you this book. You can read it through. You can see some of this. This is a Ducks Unlimited book. You can have that.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Ducks Unlimited and Delta Waterfowl are probably the two major migratory conservation groups, you know, that are out there. And there's a lot of other ones, but those two are really in the forefront. They have magazines they send, and they're first of all they're conservationists, and they're also restorationists. They spend almost all their money on restoration, restoring wetlands for habitat, you know. And it's you'll see some of the figures in there that they donate, you know, and the people, some of these people, I mean, they're very wealthy people that donate lifetime, whatever they call it, you know, millions of dollars or $1 million or you know, to them. And there's also farmers that get involved, you know, that and they go in and restore their part of their farm, you know, out Midwest, you know, the mainly in the Midwest, that's a migratory. There's the prairie, as they call it, the prairie, with pothole country. You know, where the majority of the ducks in the United States breed, and they're affected by dryness. You know, if it's very dry, then you know, then the predators they try to curtail the predation. You know, by not eliminating the predators, but making it hard for them to get to the ducks, you know.
I also imagined to work on imagining that water quality improvement must be part of wetland conservation.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I mean, those have direct positive impact, not just on birds, but people's lives too.
Well, when I grew up, there were a lot of ducks around, you know, and not like they were 100 years ago, but and what happened is the natural food for the ducks, the wild rice and stuff, got eliminated, you know, got bumped out by the invasive species, you know, your cattails, your phragmites, your Japanese knotweed, you know, and so the wild rice went away, you know. And the other thing that killed it was, and especially back in the 40s and 30s and 50s, is that these tankers that you go up the Hudson River to Albany, they would come down, and they would flush their bilges after they'd done. And I used to see oil slicks on the, not thick oil slicks, but in the weeds, you know, all the time when I was a kid. You know, and you don't see that anymore, obviously. But and it was illegal then, but they still did it because they didn't want to go in the ocean and flush it with salt water. They wanted the fresh water flush. And again, that was a big thing to me. I mean, and I just, you know, it bothered me then. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, that pretty much went away. I think they monitored it a lot better or somehow. But
have you ever practiced a duck calls?
Yeah.
We were just listening to a record of instruction how you can do the duck calls. Yeah. It's like learning a whole language.
It is. I mean, I'm not very. I mean, I can do it. This is originally a fairly inexpensive duck call. This is brand new, but it's really, to me, it's a nice call. That's a feeding chuckle.
That cuckoo 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 sound, is that?
That's
is
a feeding that chuckle.
Feeding
chuckle, yeah. The funny thing is I never really started duck calling until maybe 25, 30 years ago.
Why?
Because when I grew up, my father said, if you don't know how to call, you're going to scare the ducks. So I said, well, I don't know how to call. So I never really learned, you know. And I never. And back then, the duck calls weren't as good as they are today. You know, they were, but, you know, I could never make them sound like a duck.
Well, I'm just so fascinated because some birders are really good at imitating bird calls, and they really learn how to do it. And some of them are really convincing.
Sure.
And the hunters having to learn the speech pattern of ducks. Mm-hmm. It's just, I like when people are doing that because I came to the United States not being able to speak English. And it was so hard to learn somebody else's language. And then to see people making such effort to learn even non-human language. Mm-hmm. It's just,
well, there's a lot to it. I mean, you know, again, it's a lot of fun too. I mean, you know, especially if you can attract the duck. I mean, half the time they go the other way anyway. So, but you know, but you think you're doing the right thing, or
right,
you know,
yeah.
and earlier in the season, it's easier because the ducks aren't used to, you know, they aren't as wary. You know, it's like everything else is. The smart ones are smart.
That's another thing that's fascinating. I was reading how people can use. You can really have many strategies to place decoys in the V shape or whatever shapes. And over this, throughout the season, ducks start learning it, and they're not going to be tricked easily as much compared to earlier. I mean, those are really fascinating. They're pretty smart, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, and they're survivalists. I mean, they it's like everything else. I mean, They want to live to be tomorrow too. I mean, you know, and they have enough to worry about predators and other things, you know, that are going after them.
And so on the hunter side, you have to keep thinking that, okay, this V-shape no longer work. What am I going to do next?
I'll tell you the truth. You know, when I'm hunting out there and I'm in the blind, if I don't shoot a duck, it's not a big deal. You know, it's not. You know, it's more being out there and doing it. You know, than the rest of it. We paddle. I hunt the duck blind in the morning. Mm-hmm. You know, until, you know, 9 o'clock, then 9:30, then we go back to camp and have breakfast, which is nice. That's always nice.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'd be out there all day with nothing, you know.
Well, thank you so much for the wonderful interview.
Well, I hope it works out.
Oh, it totally does. Thank you.
was a diving duck. Now after a moment of wish, I was a diving duck. I would dive on the bottom, never would come up. Don't ever take a mad woman to be your friend. Don't ever take a mad woman to be your friend. She will get all your money, give it to another man. Now married woman, always been my craze. Now married woman, always been my craze. Now married woman, gonna carry me to my grave. Now ain't it hard to love someone as dead? Now ain't it hard to love someone as dead? You can't get her when you want her, have to use her when you can. Now the sun gonna shine in my back door someday. Now the sun gonna shine in my back door someday. Now the wind gonna rise, gonna blow my blues away. Now I went to the railroad, looked up at the sun. Now I went to the railroad, looked up at the sun. Walking done.
Diving Duck Blues by Sleepy John Estes from I Ain't Gonna Be Worried No More, 1929-1941. Huge thanks to Pat Walsh, the owner of Swamp Angel Antiques, who was my guest today for this wonderful interview. In the same building, that Day and Holt building, is also a home to a custom framing shop run by Pat's son Phil. And I hope the Walsh family business will continue in this very location for another century and on, because I think it's really important for a town to keep family businesses like this. You know, they truly contribute to the identity of the community. And the things they carry, like old hand tools and, of course, duck decoys and stuff like that, that you can find at Pat's store, are, I feel like they're not just to be consumed, but something to live with. You know, they're, I feel like, the manifestations of possibilities, you know, absolute empowerment in the forms of objects, you know, tools and stuff. It's a reminder of the fact that you can do really fun things with your own hands. You know, it's the same kind of joy I feel in used bookstores and art supply stores. You know, just the manifestation of possibilities. And I really think we need things like that, that are not made for mindless consumption, but for us to live as a human being with an agency. You know, things that makes you smile, like Pat says about, you know, when he was talking about how to choose duck decoys for yourself. And so if you ever want to feel that kind of joy, Swamp Angel Antiques is there for you. Located at 349 Main Street, Catskill. And I'll be posting a transcript of this interview that also includes the relevant links and photos on this radio show, Bequency's website, which is at bequency.substack.com. You can see Well, I'll be posting photos of the duck decoys that's discussed on this show. And also, I'm making a short online-only special content about duck decoys made from recycled materials. I mean, I couldn't do it on the radio because it needs some kind of visuals to fully appreciate what Pat is telling us about them. And so they'll be there on the same Substack website. And there also are some of my past Bequincy interviews with local bird people in the Hudson Valley. Those are also posted on the same website. Again, it's bequincy.substack.com. And so that was it for the interview part, but I still have like 10 minutes left, so let's listen to another track from that same compilation, Wiser Than the Wisdom of Geese, U.S. Game Culture Discs, 1940s to 50s, that came out in 2020, released by Canary Records. I want to play recordings of duck call, yet more duck call instructions, but this one is performed by Philip Alt, recorded in Pekin, Illinois. Really, because I'm now practicing duck calls myself. I guess just so I can annoy my birding friends, maybe. But maybe I can bring ducks come and maybe we could see it, you know, up close or maybe close enough. And, I mean, if all fail, I'll maybe try to make music with it or whatever. But duck calls, truly fascinating. Another tool that brings the possibility of seeing ducks up close. More excitement. Anyhow, before I run out of time, I'll shut up and play this stuff. Again, Duck Calling by Philip Alt. Stay tuned for WGXC 90.7 FM. This is Bequincy.
In a few of your spare moments, this record will help you master the coveted art of calling ducks with a duck call. Your instructor, Philip E. Alt, believes that knowing what to say and when is more important than how you say it. We'll confine our instructions to the calling of mallards, because others of the puddler class, pintails, baldpates, gaudwells, teal, and broadbills, respond consistently well to mallard calling. Let's pick up a duck call and place the end of the call firmly in the fork between the thumb and first finger of the hand so that the end of the call rests against the center palm of the hand. Now, place the mouthpiece in your mouth with the lips partly covering the end and blow these words, cack, 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 cack. It is helped and controlled by the tongue and the lips, with the breath coming from as deep down in the chest as possible and exerting a strong breath pressure against the call. That, of course, is just the elementary procedure in making the key tone of the various calls which make up the wild duck language, and sounds like this when applied to the duck call. Now suppose we start off and give you the first of the three essential calls in the correct sequence, used in working a flock of ducks off quite a distance, clear to the point of settling them down in the decoy. Each call will be given twice for clarification. However, in actually working a flock of ducks, each call should be repeated as often as necessary, as indicated by the reaction of the ducks. Now, the first call to use is the long call or greeting call, and should be made only to ducks at quite some distance away, but should never be given when the ducks are in close. The second and next call to use will be the come on in or come on back call, which is given when the ducks are about 200 yards off and coming toward the decoys, or immediately after they passed over you and going away. Note carefully the full-voiced quacks of this call that ducks always make on water when they're happy and neighborly, like this. Now the third and last call to use is the feeding chuckle when the ducks are in close. It's the confidential chatter of a hen mallard mixed with an occasional optimistic quack, 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 and is the most seductive call of all. It is made with the help of the tongue as you blow the words ticket, 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 softly and very rapidly like this. Now, if you will please turn to part two on the other side of this record, we will take you with us in a duck blind. We're in the blind now, loading our guns and scanning the sky for the first flock of ducks to appear. Ordinarily, we're going to open up on ducks that are all of a half mile away, giving the long call or greeting call. There's a flock now. Looks like about 25 mallards. So we grab the duck call and start blowing loud and high in their direction so it will surely carry to them. Notice how this call is made to simulate two or three mallard hens on the water, joining their calls and pleading with those ducks to come down to them. Listen. Now, it's entirely possible that those birds have already been called in several times and have had several rounds of shot thrown in their faces. If that's the case, they'll be nervous, turn away when you open up, and few callers will even waste their time on them. But if they're interested, and they are breaking in flight and turning toward us, which gives us the cue to start the come on in or come on back call. The flock is steadily coming toward us, losing altitude, eyeing our decoys and trying to make up their minds. That's the time to give them the confidential chatter of the feeding chuckle, cramming in an optimistic quack, 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 quack of contentment as they come nearer and nearer like this. Chattering is suspended as they pass over us. We don't want to attract their attention to us in the blind. Now they're going away, so we start the come on back call again. Swinging short, coming back. The feeding chuckle. Passing by, the come on back call. That did it. Here they come. They're satisfied. They've heard no unnatural silence and calling. What a sight this is as we peep over the edge of our blind. Coming, coming, riding in on rigid wings, we can begin to pick out the green heads of the drakes now. A little more of the feeding chuckle. They're rocking gently to lose altitude quickly. They stick out their orange-colored legs. They're hovering over the decoys. Okay, let them have it. Three ducks hit the water with a resounding splash. Well, that's it, friends, the ultimate in duck hunting. Anything else is anticlimax. To us, the thrills of duck hunting are measured by the part we feel we've played in making it possible for you. Good luck and good hunting.
So that was the duck call instructions by Philip Alt from, again, the compilation Wiser Than the Wisdom of Geese, U.S. Game Culture Discs, 1940s to 1950s. Quack, quack, quack. Quack, 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 quack. The positive, optimistic quack, quack, quack. Quack, 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 quack. I mean, it truly is like learning a whole new language to be even able to tell the difference between different calls. But I'm gonna try. Like I said, I got now I have a duck call of my own to practice with, and I really liked it, how this particular recording ends with such a radio drama feel to it, almost like listening to a broadcast of like a sports game or something. But anyhow, that was it for my show today. You've been listening to Waveforms WGXC Acra 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. And this program has been Bequency, Meet Bird People in the Hudson Valley. And I have been Mayuko. I'm here every fourth Saturday of the month at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. So I will be back on June 28th at 11 a.m. I hope you can join me again. Coming up next here on WGXC is selections from Waveform's Transmission Art Archive, a specialized online resource of artists' experiments with the electromagnetic spectrum in form of concept. Not that I know what that means, but if you listen, you will know. Today's selection is 1,000 words per meter, 2011 work by Sarah Washington and Voice Station 1, which is a work by Malike Kalin that was made in 2021. So I hope you stick around and enjoy our programming that go on the weekend and into the next week. Until I see you or hear you or you hear me next time, I hope you have a wonderful birding, wonderful weekend, and stay warm because it's kind of cold in the Hudson Valley. So stay warm and have a great weekend.